Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. An article on slow medicine in the New York Times a little while ago caught our attention for the very old dose of slow medicine. And we discovered that Dr. Dennis McCullough, a family physician and geriatrician at Dartmouth Medical School, really has spent a lot of time developing slow medicine and writing about it and thinking about it. He's been an in-the-trenches family physician and geriatrician for 30 years, a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Medical School, and serves as a faculty member in the Department of Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. He's a member of the American Geriatric Society, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the Society of Teachers of Family Medicine, and the American Medical Directors Association, as well as the co-author of The Little Black Book of Geriatrics. This book is directed to the children of elderly parents, and also it tells the story of his mother, who evolved from a vital 85-year-old retiree to a feeble 92-year-old dying in hospice care. Not so much, he says, from any particular disease, so much as aggressive frailty that's common among the oldest of old people. It is for friends and relatives to rescue the elderly, he believes, from standard medical care, and slow medicine involves a lot of hard work. While the aging parent is still vital and lively, children must not fool themselves that this happy situation will last forever. This is the time to reinsert themselves back into the parent's life, to show up at doctor visits, and to raise unpleasant topics like advance directives and health proxies. After a few more years, should you drive? Can you still manage at home? And to help create routines that compensate for a slipping memory and slightly wobbly balance. It's a valuable guide. It's actually the kind of book that I wish I had a chance to read about a year ago. Dr. Dennis McCullough is our guest this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. A lot of people are living through this, so call if you need advice. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you are wanting to send an email, then send an email, and you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Dr. McCullough, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Kathleen. Thanks for the nice summary of the book.
Yeah, and thanks for writing the book. So many of us find ourselves in this situation, and we wish we had thought about all of these issues before. All of a sudden, there you are in the hospital, and you're in the rehab center, and the nursing home, and back to the hospital because of fevers. And, oh, man, it's quite something to navigate at the end of your parents' life. It really is. Why don't we start with the story of your mom? Because it's nice to honor people who were close to us, and she was a vital 85-year-old and had a tough life, and you figured a lot of this out by helping her, didn't you?
I did. It came home to me when I had to be on the other side of the desk or the bed, so to speak, as a son and not in the doctor role anymore, and really see the intricacies of the problems that older people and their families faced. I think it made me respect even more what I had already respected a lot, which is the resiliency of older people and their families in this period, which often requires a substantial amount of caregiving, psychological, emotional, spiritual, and much of the time physical caregiving.
And the model that we tend to have in this country is, instead of that, we just put all kinds of needles and do tests and recommend certain surgeries. We have a hospital high care mentality, which may be good for many people. For those who are frail and elderly, it may not be the best thing.
It may not be the best thing, but I think the complex part of it is the discerning judgments about which high-tech things will work and actually improve quality of life and make things easier for older people, and which things are unnecessary. Or, in fact, even detrimental. So I think the slow medicine is all about balancing high-tech care and much more personalized, customized care for an older people and an older person and their family. That's, I think, the secret of it, to enter that process and take the time to really understand an individual in a family situation.
Mm-hmm. It's hard for us, and I want you to explain why it is hard and how we can break this difficulty of encouraging really heart-to-heart discussions with your family members who may disagree about what needs to be done with your parents or your relatives, and also with your parents to find out exactly if they want to be taken care of and run the risk of a major procedure, even though they're quite frail. A lot of these discussions are hard because they involve our dying.
They're hard for that reason, and they also involve all of our histories.
Yeah.
So reconnecting with your siblings and with your parents in this very intimate way can bring out a conflict that may have been there in the past and keep recurring again. But I think the mistake is that people put it off until it becomes a crisis, and then they end up trying to discuss important things like advanced directives and values without having really reconnected in a more intimate way to learn what their parents, for instance, have become as they've gotten older.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of us age right to the very end of our lives, and we're maturing and changing. We sometimes forget that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your mom, the end of your mom's life. Your mom died in hospice care, didn't she?
She did, and it was a wonderful thing. And so, you know, where do you start the story of an end?
Right.
I think she would start it from probably a year and a half before that, where because of tiny little strokes and difficulty getting around, literally walking, she had to leave a lovely apartment where she'd lived for 19 years and in the end with a lot of support, and go to a nursing home, which she didn't really want to do, and we didn't want her to be in, but she had to be there. Then she slowly drifted downhill in the nursing home and realized probably 6 months before her death, she had a premonition that she was really ready to die, and she began to say, "Oh, this is so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I'm perfectly happy to let go.
Mm-hmm.
And every night
mm-hmm.
I pray that I won't wake up," because she was bedridden by that time and had to have two people help her to move. So she mentally was quite clear. Then, and this is very common, and I think one of the challenges for families and for care systems, in the nursing home, of course, there's this orientation toward trying to keep people going.
Right.
Even when they don't want to be going anymore. And nursing homes have to be careful because they can't undermine regulations that have to do with adequate feeding, for instance, and weight maintenance and things like that. But at the end, the routine became so demanding for my mother and the hospice was already involved in the nursing home, where she was being awakened to eat
mm-hmm.
and to take pills that had very little value for her. So we slowly began to work with the team at the nursing home and hospice to get her free of medications. And then finally, when an opportunity came for her to be in a residential hospice where she had even more freedom because she could follow her own rhythms, and we moved her there and thought she might not even survive the move, but she started in this pattern, and hospice people will tell you that this is not uncommon. She found her own rhythms, which were sleeping for 22 hours straight,
hmm.
waking for 2 hours, having a cup of coffee and a little toast, hmm. sometimes a little more, being very clear during that 2 hours in terms of relationships, and then going to sleep for another 22 hours.
Hmm.
And she did this for 5 weeks, and that was really some of the very best time we had with her. Because when she was in the nursing home, she was so exhausted, she really couldn't speak very much and talk about things. But in the end, she talked about her funeral and a service and talked about stories that we hadn't really even heard
yes.
before.
Yes.
So interesting and so rich.
Yes. That happened with my dad, too. The stories that he told me I will forever hold in my heart.
Yeah.
It was just, he just opened up. He knew what was happening. He wanted the lights turned out, as he said, over and over.
Mm-hmm.
But those afternoons that we had, and oh my, they were precious. They were just precious.
Well, they are wonderful, and they're part of a legacy. You know, they leave you and your family with the stories to tell and an understanding of your dad's life that otherwise you couldn't have accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very interesting a book that was written by a minister in California about end of life called Mrs. Hunter's Happy Death. And in it, he he raises the question about whether or not we sometimes medicalize lives and demand of patients and their families that's so much energy for testing and treatments that have very little utility and sometimes are just futile, that we leave no energy left for the process and the time of dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what hospice allowed us to have. And it sounds as if you had a piece of that too, Kathleen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What a gift.
Yeah, it is a gift. It is interesting what your mother said, that she just wanted to fall asleep and not wake up. My dad said the same. But we don't die that way usually, do we? It's a long process. It's a hard process to die.
For most people, it is a long process. And for many people, it is a hard process. Though I think that with family support and involvement and a return to normal rhythms, sometimes it doesn't have to be quite as hard as a medicalized death where things are being done to people to the very end.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that we do that? Why is it that we sometimes perform procedures that are highly questionable? Is it because families disagree about what needs to be done, or doctors just have this mentality, keep someone alive at all costs, or that patients have not made their directives known? What is it?
Well, I think all three parties involved here, older people sometimes continue to have a kind of hope for more than can be accomplished, and where the hope should be about quality of life, they continue to think about cures, and doctors sometimes continue to foster that. For children, adult children and others, we don't want to let go, and that's understandable because it's kind of the last time we have with a parent, and sometimes we function out of guilt too, and that's something that can be worked on. And the third party in this triangle of people that create the context for an older person, the healthcare medical care establishment, I don't think there's too much motivation for sometimes good reasons to want to try to do still another thing, because no doctor wants to feel as if he's helpless in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think doctors have to, in a sense, mature to learn how to let go as well. Painful for them.
Mm-hmm. And is that process starting, do you think? They are starting to learn that.
I think so. I am so encouraged by the response of the medical profession to this. A lot of people, a lot of physicians and nurses and others have responded by saying, we know this is the case. We don't know how to get out of this morass. And I think by empowering families more and elders and getting these discussions going earlier on, there is a way out.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes hard work, and it takes breaking some taboos, getting into difficult areas, such as you point out, our own mortality.
Did you start having conversations with your mom when she was a pretty vital 85-year-old?
Yes, and they were kind of on the light side.
Yeah.
That I think sometimes that's the best way to do it, to not go straight head on at it by trying to have too many discussions about advanced directives and many different, you know, scenarios for dying, but to joke about it, to listen to her own responses to friends who have died. And when you get into your 80s, you're losing, of course, lots of friends,
mm-hmm.
most of them by the time you get into your 90s. And I found that even some movies can help to lighten things up. And there are some wonderful movies now, you know, The Savages, Two Weeks with Sally Field, Away from Her with Julie Christie, new films coming out that I think kind of soften the journey for older people and for their families.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about this advocacy team of friends and relatives who need to be mustered. Who are you talking about? Why do all those people need to be called forth?
Well, there's several reasons, Kathleen. The first reason for getting what is I term a circle of concern. That is to say, people who know enough about your parent and care enough about them to probably be the people who will show up at the funeral.
Right.
You know, that's
right.
There's going to be a group of people who are out there and do that.
Mm-hmm.
One reason is that Friends of your parents and people who have known them for a long period of time will offer a perspective sometimes on them that family members don't get to experience directly. Things are shared with peers and friends that aren't with adult children sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a better perspective. And also you create a dynamic where all the discussions don't have to take place between you and your parents. Some of them can take place between your parents and friends and spiritual advisors, ministers, neighbors. And that can diffuse some of the tension within a family. So one of the things is getting a different perspective. I think the second is that we have come to forget that in the past there were very large families, and many different family members carried the load of caregiving and caring at the end, and because they were oftentimes nearby. Now with more fragmented families and smaller families, families, I think, sometimes turn in on themselves too quickly, feeling that only family members are interested in this and should carry the load. And then these designated caregivers, oftentimes self-designated caregivers, burn out. So the second reason for having a circle of concern is that you need some relief and
mm-hmm.
help.
It's a very hard thing to do, and you write about that in the book as well. It's you can burn out. You can really burn out when you're trying to carry on with your own life, your own work, your own children in many cases. It's too much.
Yes. It feels that way along the way, although ultimately most people who go through this caregiving feel that they were privileged and
right.
blessed in a way to have that kind of experience, which is a part of all of our lives,
yeah.
but losing our parents.
Yeah.
But along the way, I think turning to support groups and finding ways, and maybe using this as an opportunity to take care of yourself better,
mm-hmm.
Finding that balance in your own life.
It's also harder because we live far away from our parents now, too, and sometimes just a, you know, a 100-mile drive is like a 1,000-mile drive when you're
yeah.
dealing with these issues. We have a whole different way of living now. We don't live where we grew up.
Yes, and I know that so well. I was a 1,000-mile
mm-hmm.
away son, and through the broad reaches of Ontario to get from Vermont to northern Michigan with my mother, and it wasn't easy. But you know what I did find, Kathleen, is that the circle of concern worked so well for my mother, that there were people who deeply cared about her as friends. And what I did to some substantial degree was made sure that I stayed in touch with her friends as well, and was thanked them for that all mm-hmm. they did along the way.
Yeah.
And I think that assuages one's guilt to some degree. But more importantly, I think it creates a culture of caring and reinforces these friendships that lead to caring for one another, which actually is now becoming, I think, a way that more and more older people are thinking about their future. They are saying, our children are scattered. We may have to band up as
right.
a group of peers. And
right.
you see the, you know, the Beacon Hill Village project in Boston and similar projects where neighborhoods are joining together, older people in neighborhoods, to figure out ways to support one another staying in their own homes, which I think is a very laudable goal.
Sure is. Let's welcome phone calls, and our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. Dr. Dennis McCullough is our guest. His book is My Mother, Your Mother, Embracing Slow Medicine, The Compassionate Approach to Caring for Your Aging Loved Ones. We also have an email address if you'd like to use it, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of our program, our guest is Dr. Dennis McCullough. He's been a family physician and geriatrician for 30 years, a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Medical School, serves as a faculty member in the Department of Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School, is a member of the American Geriatric Society, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the Society of Teachers of Family Medicine, and author of what But I think it's an important book as we deal with our aging and becoming frail and eventually dying parents. My Mother, Your Mother, Embracing Slow Medicine, the Compassionate Approach to Caring for Your Aging Loved Ones. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. And we start our calls with Mike from Appleton. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
I will read your book with much interest. I've been caring for my parents. My father passed away at 86. My mother is close to 90. And I reinserted myself in their lives, 15, 20 years ago. And perhaps my story can be of help to other people. As you approach, you know, the inevitable end, you can certainly make things easier for yourself and your family by becoming actively involved, especially with the doctors. It's not that I've been skeptical of some of the prescriptions and some of the things that they've wanted to do, but as time goes by, one becomes really, really informed and aware of you know, what can be done, what should be done, what is a good idea and what is not a bad idea. You become kind of your doctor, your parents' doctor. And I took it to the point in which my own career was affected because my decision was they're more important to me than my career. And so my time was invested in them to make their passage easy. And my siblings supported that and in a way also supported me.
Hmm.
Kind of an unusual situation, but I'm glad the way we did it. And thank you for your time.
Hmm. Thank you so much for the call, Dr. McCullough.
Mike, I really admire people like Mike who are doing this, and I think that what I've seen is more and more sons are actually stepping up to the plate on this, and this work is done still predominantly by daughters. And for siblings to group together and find ways to support a caregiver, be he a son or a daughter, is a terrific way to do it. I think that the fact that Mike, quote, stepped in with his parents, and maybe they were quite reluctant about his stepping in early on, was probably the key to this for the whole family. And it's difficult territory to get into in the beginning, but I think it's so worthwhile. But that the early involvement is when everything is still going well, as opposed to waiting for the first crisis to happen. That's the time to strike.
Thanks for the call. Tim from Madison. Hi, Tim.
Oh, hi. I got the title of the book from online and from you, so thank you very much. Having issues with my parents now, and my sister and I are dealing with this, about a year or so ago, I'm a paralegal and was a paralegal in the National Guard. And about a year ago, before I got out, I just made sure we were all up to speed on healthcare, powers of attorney, living will, and the will. And it even turned out that the will was not reflecting what their wishes were. And I was a really strong advocate in making sure my parents went back to the attorney to get that redone so it did reflect what they wanted. And we got that all squared away, and they would misplace paperwork. So we got original to my sister and copies to them. So we know where that is. And that's, for me, at least a huge relief, but the issues are starting. My father is in his mid-70s, as is my mom, and she's been, or my father has had a franchise with a certain tax preparation business, which will remain nameless, but the business, I'll call it that. But anyway, he's been diagnosed with pre-Alzheimer's and with short-term memory loss, and his staff are covering for him. I was a little bit late on my taxes. I was just calling back to ask a question. Were taxes mailed out on Monday to me to sign and turn in? And he could not answer that. He could not remember that. I've heard secondhand that his staff is covering for him, basically. He'll be making a decision to go one way with someone's taxes, and the staff will be checking it. They'll ask him in the afternoon, and he won't be able to answer it because he doesn't remember. He's been told by his doctor he needs to sell his business and be out of this business, be in a business that requires some cognitive functioning. And there's issues with that. He's reluctant to do that, as well as the company is saying he has to work there for 2 years. And yet, by the same token, that's a good thing because he's been doing that all these years. There may be something he could do that could be at a reduced level, and it could help him feel useful and functional to be going into that office. And yet, this company wants to be like McDonald's, and he's been grandfather clause to be laid back, have the dog in, you know, things that the company doesn't want him to be doing. So it's a huge ball of wax of issues. What I've heard you say, though, Kathleen, at another show, and it sounds like this, is here in Dane County, with the developmentally disabled world, we have something called self-directed services, where in theory, at least, that and in some cases in practice, people can choose and design what their lives look like. And what I hear this doctor saying, and what I've heard you say in other programs, Kathleen, is, what would meet this person's need? What would work for them? Would it be going to the restaurant every day and spending time at a restaurant and having the social? Would it be going to an office, even if it's just to sort the mail or something?
Mm-hmm.
Or would it be sleeping 22 hours a day?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I don't really have any comments other than my sister and I are at the beginning stages of our process.
Mm.
My parents live in Iowa. It's a good 8-hour drive for me. I'm in Madison. My sister's in the Twin Cities. There's some conversation about them perhaps moving up to the Twin Cities, maybe. But the other issue is my dad loves to walk his dogs, and he lives in a small town in Iowa. And walking his dogs is good exercise for him, and he's out doing it. And my sister and I have creatively thought, what if we found the right dog that he could be a companion dog visitor type person to visit shut-ins with the right kind of trained dog, or have a dog walking service, or, you know, but obviously we can't be the ones to come up with the ideas. We need to, you know, we're just exploring the whole gamut of issues here. And I'm so thankful for this book, and I'm so thankful that you're at least talking about it. And Kathleen, that you have talked about it in addition to what you're talking about today.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry if I've talked too much. Any comments about anything that I've said, I'm open.
Okay. We were listening on the right day, that's for sure. Dr. McCullough.
Thank you, Kathleen. Well, Tim's story, it was Tim, not Kim, yes?
Yes, it's Tim.
Mm-hmm. Story, there are so many issues there, but let me just tease out a few of them. I think the issue of continuing employment or continuing engagement with work is very, very important. And I've seen situations crafted very, very carefully in offices where a man or a woman had some cognitive decline, and it was handled very, very humanely with slow downsizing of workload and tasks, and focusing more on relationship skills that older people who have early dementia may still have. Whereas their memory skills and some of their other skills are certainly in decline. On the other hand, I think we're facing futures with large employers who, as Tim points out, may not be as flexible in crafting a solution, or may have more rigid rules related to the way they run their business. In a sense, we are at the verge here of creating our own futures. And if these issues are engaged more aggressively, or at least assertively, by us now individually and brought forward, I think we're going to have better futures ourselves as working men and women who want to continue to be productive over time. So around the work part, I've seen stories go both ways, and I certainly encourage trying to craft a good solution for Tim's dad in this case.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of it that he brings up the moving part and the dogs and the small town in Iowa and all, it's becoming clear to most people that keeping an elder with a cognitive, incognitive decline in a familiar circumstance really helps to avoid the depression that sometimes accompanies dementia. How to craft that, and here's where the circle of concern comes in, and working with neighbors and trying to figure out ways to, for as long as possible, prevent relocation from happening, unless you have a really good place to land with supportive services for a couple where one has dementia. So Tim raises a terrific bunch of questions, and I think that this is where the cutting edge is going to be. On families recognizing these situations, knowing what better solutions are, and beginning to ask employers and also doctors and hospitals around medical care for different and better ways to deal with family members who are having these problems that are come with aging.
Right. And as somebody who deeply appreciates dogs, I say he's got to keep the dogs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Tim, thanks very much for your call. Margie from Franklin, hi.
Hi. I'm a clinical dietitian that specializes in senior care, and I've really enjoyed listening to everything Dr. McCauley says. I'm anxious to get the book. I like the idea of embracing slow medicine because so many times there's just too much being done, either medically or procedurally, for people at end of life, and it's very important, I think, like you're saying, about communication between family members and between parents about what they really want, but that has to start early before changes happen. And what you had said about is having others involved that know your parents to help out and to talk to them. And, you know, I used to say that to my teenagers. You don't have to tell me everything, but you got to talk to somebody. You know, one of your aunts or your uncles or something, if it's something you don't want to talk to me about. And I think it's the same thing with our elders. And about having other people around. You could almost, kids could almost help parents to design their own board of directors in terms of, okay, who's the doctor? Who's going to look out for how she's getting to the grocery? Who's going to look out for, is she really cooking at home? There's a lot of people, older people at home, that aren't using the stove anymore because they're afraid. Their eyesight's changed. They're afraid of burning themselves. I had one lovely lady that was eating cheese sandwiches three times a day. And there's a lot of things that home visits by home care agencies, home visits by home care dietitians, to see what's actually going on in the home, and that could especially be good for someone that has family out of town, because I can make calls to family out of town and say, I saw your mother this week, you know, this is what's happening now. And I think the face of care for seniors is changing, because we're keeping them, we're doing our darndest to try and keep them in the community longer. Because as Dr. said, the nursing homes can be very confining. They can't follow their own routine. And many times people do so much better at home.
Mm-hmm. Dr. McCullough.
Margie, those are very nice observations that you make about what's going on. Just to turn a minute to the board of directors kind of thing that parents should maybe pull together. One thing I would add to that is that adult children, when they go to visit their parents, should also spend some time with the board of directors because we learn so much by those off to the side conversations with our parents, friends, and the people who help them out, that we would never learn directly from our parents because they may forget to tell us, or they may want to cover something up. So spending time with your parents' friends is very, very important to do. And the whole issue of connections between this increasing group of people, as Margie turned points out, who are involved in assessing older people at home, people who do Meals on Wheels and visiting nurses and other home helpers, and conveying that information to people who are helping the doctors and nurses with medical decisions, because there is a great big disconnect in the system now between people who are gathering in very, very important information and the medical care system, which is functioning independently of that information and not acknowledging it or not being willing to pay attention to what people are saying, who know someone in their own context.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your call. Ray is next from Medford. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Before I get started, I just want to tell you that I think you are the greatest host on public radio.
Well, thank you, Ray.
I just went through this with my mother last week. She passed away last Thursday.
Condolences.
Sorry.
We were able to have my brothers and I take care of her. She was in her own place, and she did not want to go to a nursing home or into a hospital even. She, the only time she was in the hospital was to have her three sons. So she was 88 years old.
Mm.
And my plug is for hospice. They were just great. This kind of came on suddenly. She was diagnosed with cancer in February, and it was really aggressive, and we just were able to, with hospice's help and all their care, we were able to keep her at home. So I just wanted to put that plug in, and I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. And Ray's going through a hard time right now, too.
It is a hard time, and the depth of feeling you can hear, we feel it ourselves when we hear that kind of story. But they did wonderful work, and it sounds as if the early engagement of hospice made a big, big difference. Sadly, the referrals to hospice coming from physicians and hospitals it comes oftentimes so late in the course of what is clearly a terminal illness.
Mm-hmm.
And the average stay in hospice is still very, very short.
Right,
within,
yes.
You know, 1 to 2 weeks, as you probably are aware, Kathleen.
Mm-hmm.
So to have hospice guide you through months at the end rather than just days or weeks is truly a gift. And every family that is involved with hospice almost invariably says they were wonderful and we wish we had maybe done it a little earlier.
Mm-hmm. And it varies, I've found, Dr. McCullough, from state to state. My dad was in Illinois, and I'm in Wisconsin. I mean, I love Illinois. I grew up there, but I have a feeling that the Wisconsin system is so superb to Illinois. And then trying to maneuver the whole financial system, as you write about it, you go into this not knowing how much Medicare is going to cover and when you need to be off hospice and on it and whether or not you should use your benefits and otherwise, you can just spend. My dad's concern, because he was a Depression-era guy, was that he was spending way too much money
mm-hmm.
on hospice because he had to pay for it, you know. And that just made that just stirred him up so much. I said, Dad, it's worth it, you know. It's worth it. But it's a very hard financial system to maneuver, don't you think?
Oh, it is, and there are hidden costs that nobody tells you about
right.
up front, copays and
right.
things that aren't fully covered, and. And all of a sudden, you agree to certain kinds of approaches or treatments, and the bills are suddenly in the thousands of dollars, and medications are very expensive, without having had the talk in advance about an honest talk about what the prospects were for actual value
mm-hmm.
from these kinds of treatments.
Mm-hmm.
So the financial consequences of this are dire for many families.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Ray, for the call. The grief thing is something, I know you lost your mom in April, I lost my dad in November, and, you know, boy, I just think about him many, many times a day, and I'm sure you do your mom.
Yes.
It's that's a long process. Let's go to Judy from Ripon. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi.
Boy, I feel like I could write a book about this myself. I'm a registered nurse, my husband's a family practitioner, and we're caring for my elderly father, and boy, I could, like I said, I could just write a book. There are so many things I'd like to pass on to anybody that is considering caring for an elderly person in their home. Boy, it's tough. It's really, really tough, especially because we still have small children in our home, and he requires so much care. So I think one of the top things I would have to say would be to get help. I mean, even though I'm a registered nurse, we still have nursing come into our house in the mornings just to get him going and get him bathed and that kind of stuff. Because they still have that aspect of dignity, and they don't necessarily want their kids bathing them.
Sure.
That's really significant. And the other thing is, and this sounds, you know, surprising to some people, but I actually have said that I have to limit his medications in number. You know, I picked out this random number. I said five. We're going to have five medications. He's got a lot of chronic illnesses, but he's in his mid-80s. And let's pick out five of the most important meds. And a lot of the other things, like the statin meds and things like that really are not going to make any more difference now in him longevity-wise, we eliminate it. I mean, I think there's so much to be said about limiting and really realistically looking at the studies to what kinds of longevity you're going to get with some of these meds. You know, it's confusing to him if there's a day that I'm not there to give him his meds. To have more than a certain number of meds is overwhelming. You know, and so we've said, let's pick out these five most important meds that we know will make a difference in your life and how you feel, like his antidepressants, you know, his thyroid medicine, his calcium, that kind of stuff. Those kinds of things are the most important things, and I think people need to take a realistic look at what they're doing with their elderly, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you so much for the call.
I think Judy is right to very, very aggressively have discussions about which medicines make a difference. And usually, with a sympathetic physician, you can work on those kinds of issues. It's much more difficult on the East Coast, for instance. There's much more multi-specialty care and involvement with older persons without a coordinating physician kind of at the helm trying to steer the ship through these difficult times and waters. And yet, the medication overuse is very, very high, and physicians are under a lot of pressure to be more and more rigorous and aggressive with medications, regardless of someone's age. And the medical profession really has to shift its perspective on this, as Judy points out. When you get to a certain point in life, either because of aging or aging in a combination of diseases, you have to look at the pros and cons of what medications are doing in relation to their potential side effects and their costliness.
We go next to Rose from Chatfield, Minnesota. Hi, Rose.
Top of the morning to the Irish lass.
Thanks, Rose. To you, too.
I'm on a first-name basis with this. My father died in my arms, and my mother died in my arms. I would love to have taken care of your father, Kathleen. I remember one of your shows that you took your son to Chicago, and he played the music that your father liked.
Yes.
I remember that. I'll always remember that.
Yes,
but, yes, my father did. He died in my arms. He had cancer. I left my job in the Twin Cities, and I came back to my hometown, Chatfield. It's 18 miles south of Rochester. And my girlfriend from high school worked on the cancer floor at the Mayo Clinic, and I called her every day at work for 6 months, and I called her every night at home, and she told me about cancer. And so it was, and my father had a great sense of humor, and then I moved in with my Irish mother, and I lived with her for 6 years. And it was a gift, an absolute gift. And I learned a lot, and I just recently completed 2 hours of hospice training at our nursing care home here in Chatfield, a town of less than, you know, 2,000 people. And the woman that gave us the training, her name was Angel. And I learned so much in just 2 hours. They needed volunteers for patients that don't have any families, and I thought, I can do this. And this Angel, she was an angel. She's under 30 years old, a nurse. And I learned about active and preactive death. I learned a lot that would have been helpful to me. But there was great sorrow in my experience because of my brother that lived and worked with my father in an insurance business. And he was stealing money from him.
Oh, no.
And on 2 days before he died, he made him write a check for a lot of money, and and I cried at night because of that. But the best thing to do is get rid of all your assets, get rid of the money, so that, because no one will darken your door if there's no money. And I just think that we don't respect older people in this culture, but it was a great experience. It was a gift. I spent this time, and the stories that I heard from my mother and my father, my Irish mother and my father, and one day my father said he wanted to know if I knew where my grandmother was born or buried, and I said, sure. So we drove out to the cemetery, and my dad didn't go to Mass that often, but my mother went every day, and I said, you don't have to have gone to, you don't have to have gone to church, Dad. You can be buried in the Catholic cemetery. So we got out of the car, and my dad said, follow me, little chickadee. My pockets are full of corn. So we went over and visited his mother's grave. It was such a wonderful, you know. And I let my my dad drive, and I drank whatever stuff he was supposed to drink. And, and you know, I let him smoke or I make him a drink or whatever. It was a wonderful experience for me, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Rose. Yeah. Thanks so much for the call. Dr. McCullough.
Well, Rose is telling these wonderful stories which and doing the wonderful work, I think, which is creating cultural change. As people come to understand that this is the way it happens in families or can happen in families, I think other people are encouraged to try it, even though it seems daunting. And there may be some bitter parts to it, as Rose also talked about with her brother. Nevertheless, I think it is a part of the deepest and most humane part of living. It's every bit as deep and important a part as having a family and children, for instance. I think it's equally maturing for us as individuals. So hats off to Rose and her Irish parents. They're wonderful stories.
Yes, they are. She's a lovely woman. Thanks, Rose, for your call. Barbara from Gilbert. Hello, Barbara.
Hi.
Hi.
Is this me? Okay. I'm the co-owner of a senior living management company, so this is a very interesting conversation to me, and I feel like I've heard all these stories before. Some of the things that I just want to talk about, we own and manage several assisted living facilities throughout the state of Wisconsin. And one of the things that I heard from a caller earlier was, you know, all these people do great at home, they do great at home. And in some cases, absolutely, people do great at home. But on the flip side of that, we are a social being. It's by nature that we're social. So we have to keep in mind that those Meals on Wheels people out there, all those other people that are going into those homes, need to keep an eye on the fact that people will, it's like a flower. If you don't water it, and what I mean by watering is that social, that interaction, that camaraderie, if you don't water someone's spiritual and emotional needs, they will wilt. I don't know how many times we've had people come into our facilities that, you know, the family said, well, they want to stay home, they want to stay home. And that's wonderful, and I will tell you, my father himself, I will have to move into his home to take care of him. And he's an 82-year-old man. He still farms. When that time comes, I promised him that he will not go anywhere. Even though I own assisted living throughout the state, I will take care of him in his own home, and that's my promise to him. But, you know, we can't, on the flip side of that, we can't neglect people because we want to, we believe that this is what they want. At this point, I've had people come in a year have lost 100 pounds. And now they have dementia-like symptoms and things along those lines. And part of that is just because they're not eating, and no one sees it.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows it. And the family calls, and they say, hey, Mom, how's everything going? And Mom doesn't want to say, you know what, I'm lonely. I can't cook.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid, and those types of things. So we have to look at it from that side. The other thing I wanted to point out real quick is I love the last caller who talked about hanging out with her dad and drinking with him and smoking with him. You know what? Get rid of those medications. You know what? This is about quality of life. One of the things that we promote in our communities is quality of life. You know what? We over-medicate our seniors. It's a proven fact. Quality of life. Let them have a drink. Let's party. You know, this is the golden years. We should be having a good time.
Okay, Dr. McCullough.
Barbara, it sounds as if you have a very enlightened philosophy in your business, and that's wonderful. The one thing that I've learned over the years is that what really pays off because people are so different as they get older, is listening and listening and listening carefully to really try to understand what is going to make somebody happy. And, you know, there are those people who are extroverted, who need to be, who enjoy sort of a social engagement. And then there are others who even live in senior communities who are more introverted and have a quiet center to their life, and the social part of it is not quite so important to them. But I think the key thing is listening carefully to try to figure out on from the past course of events in a life whether somebody, how much social engagement they're going to need. Everyone, of course, needs the spiritual and emotional support. I'm always surprised by finding that somebody who I thought was going to not benefit from being in a social setting really turns out to be pretty adaptable. You know, older people are more adaptable than we think if you give them the time to process something and kind of get ready for it, as opposed to a sudden decision, let's say, to go into assisted living, something that is approached much more slowly, maybe over a 4 or 6 month period of trying to figure out ways to acquaint somebody with what that life might be.
But, Dr. McCullough, we're out of time. Thank you so much for writing the book and for the conversation. It was just wonderful. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Kathleen. Nice to be with you.
Dr. Dennis McCullough, his book is My Mother, Your Mother, Embracing Slow Medicine, the Compassionate Approach to Caring for Your Aging Loved Ones. It has recently been published by Harper. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production in our studios. Veronica Rickert will be with you tomorrow, and I'll be with you Monday, 9, for all things political.